This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
Tonight is a huge topic that is affecting many of us, and with the recommendations coming from Austria and Germany on mandatory vaccines, it's an even more pressing issue. And tonight we're going to look at COVID-19 vaccines for 5 to 11-year-old kids, what every parent should know. And it is my honour to have Dr. Stephen Hatfield joining us. Dr. Hatfield, thank you for your time today.
Great. Nice to speak with you, Peter.
Great to have you. And a few weeks ago, we had Tony Schaefer on from London Centre for Policy Research. And we were looking at one of your papers, which was the mandated administration of mRNA vaccines are likely to decrease US special operations and intelligence force readiness. And Tony Schaefer covered that. So it's wonderful to have you on looking at this issue, but in a slightly different way. And if I can give a short introduction to our viewers, Dr. Stephen Hatfield is a specialist physician and a virologist with a military background and separate master's degrees in microbial genetics, radiation biochemistry, and experimental pathology. Since 2007, he has been involved with teaching the emergency medical response to mass trauma casualties and the response to severe pandemic outbreaks of infectious diseases. Dr. Hatfield is an adjunct professor in 2 departments at the George Washington University Medical Center and School, and has numerous peer-reviewed scientific publications. He is a national fellow of the Explorers Club and serves as a board member for 3 medical non-profit organizations. He is also the author of the book 3 Seconds Until Midnight, which deals with the US lack of pandemic preparedness, which I understand came out just months before this COVID-19 struck. So I don't know whether you're prophetic in that, Dr. Hatfield, but interesting timing on that. Could I just ask you, could you maybe fill in anything which I have left out? I had to leave most of it out, but is there anything specific which I've left out on that?
I did a postdoctoral position as a senior scientist at the Nuffield School of Pathology at Oxford. Another one, an IRTA appointment at the National Institutes of Health, and then a National Research Council appointment at the United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, where I worked on the Ebola and Marburg viruses under BSL-4 conditions. 2015, we trained the Kenyan National Medical Response Unit for response to hemorrhagic fevers. They were getting a little bit of spillover from West Africa. And after that, it's been private research.
I have watched you on numerous programs. I've watched you on War Room a number of times with Steve Bannon. So again, it is wonderful to have you on. And we're going to look at a paper which is on the website, on your website. That's drstephenhatfield.com. I'd encourage our viewers to go there and make use of the information up there. And in 3 pages, it's a short paper we're going to look at, but has huge implications and packed full and all referenced at the end. So it is worthwhile. Now, we are going to have to leave YouTube, but before we do, could I just ask you, Dr. Hatfield, about your time? I understand that you were advising Donald Trump in the White House during the COVID when it broke out, and you were giving briefings or updating. Can you just give a snapshot of kind of what that time was like and what your role was there?
Yeah, I was brought in on the 3rd of February, 2020, to assist in getting some sort of a response up and working. In 2005, the United States made a national respiratory virus plan. It was originally for influenza, but it would cover any RNA viral infection, so like COVID-19. Under the Obama administration, most of this preparedness disappeared over 8 years. The plan was forgotten. And when the outbreak began in China, there was a strong sense of urgency among some of the people that this was going to be here. And when, by the time we had our first case here, it had already spread throughout the East and the West coasts. And we have two mega regions in the United States, the LA region and the New York City mega region, New Jersey. Consequently, two different clades of the virus appeared here. Clades very close to the Wuhan strain appeared in California, and clades very particular to the what was happening in Italy had arrived over on the eastern coast of the United States. And this virus had already cycled through humans a number of times. And we see this very often, where a virus will jump from an animal into a human, or wherever the origin of this virus was. But the more it circulates through humans, the better adapted to man it becomes. And this is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to vaccinate your way out of a pandemic of this type. The COVID vaccines at the moment aren't really true vaccines. They're classified by our FDA here as a biological product.
Let's jump into that. Let me just say, let me say bye to YouTube on our side. Again, heartsfolk.org/find us. You can find over. I wanted you just to get a taster of Dr. Hatfield before we left you. You can join on all the other platforms on Rumble, Odyssey, VK, DLive, on the website, and on brand YouTube. So all over there. So let me just say bye to YouTube. And YouTube has gone, so we'll be on everything else. So can I, it's a very interesting comment you made there, Dr. Hatfield, about it not being a true vaccine. So do you want to expand on that a little bit? Because that's can be quite confusing to most of the public.
Well, when we talk of vaccines, most people are thinking of the measles vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine, the polio vaccine, yellow fever, these type of things. These viruses, they're RNA viruses, but they mutate very slowly. So you get an infection or you get a vaccination, let's say for measles, and your body develops a very long-standing immunity, lasting for years. This is because when you have a natural infection, your immune system responds to multiple different proteins in whatever virus is infecting you. So it gives you a very broad spectrum immunity against a number of the components of the virus. The messenger RNA vaccines use essentially fat molecules to transport tiny little fragments of the virus, in this case, the genetic code, the blueprints, if you will, for making what's called the spike protein. This on the coronaviruses, this is what gives it the corona-like effect, like a crown. And these proteins are on the cell surface, and they recognize a specific receptor, like a lock and key when you're trying to get in your house. Certain cells that have the key, in this case, it's a cell protein called ACE2, PCE-2. And the coronavirus, it's the correct lock. It fits in, correct key, it fits into the lock. The virus is brought into the cell where it takes over the normal cellular machinery. It's sort of the ultimate parasite in nature. The vaccine, quote, biological product, teaches your cells randomly, not specific to the airway, but any cells that these little nanoparticles come in contact with, they will enter the cell. And in response, your body will start making the spike protein of the virus and putting it on the surface of the cell so the immune system can see it. And your lymphocytes, your white blood cells, recognize this, and your macrophages, and they present this foreign protein in a certain fashion that tells your immune system that this protein isn't part of you, you're infected. And an immune response is made against several of the viral, well, with the injection, against just the spike protein. Unlike in a natural infection, it makes a response to a number of different proteins that are on the virus. So it's very, very specific. Unfortunately, the spike protein is one of the areas of the virus that undergoes a lot of mutational changes. The COVID-19 virus makes a lot of mistakes when it copies its genetic information to pass on to daughter viruses inside the cell that are forming. And there's a little bit of a war that goes on, a little bit of Darwinism, if you will. And if one of these sort of subtypes in a person has a little bit of a survival advantage over the other daughter viruses with their own different sort of little mutations here and there, then that strain tends to become dominant. And if it has a really good advantage, let's say it replicates quicker than the other daughter viruses, or it reaches a higher concentration in the body before it's sneezed or coughed out, well, then this, over a period of a couple of weeks, will become the dominant clade in that population. And this is what's been happening. Again, this is one of the reasons that you cannot vaccinate yourself out of a pandemic of this type. By the time you've made the biological product and you've distributed it and you've injected it into everybody, or at least 70% of the population, that spike protein has mutated away. The vaccination is actually selecting for mutants of the coronavirus that your immune system won't recognize. And this is what we've been seeing. The net result is that the virus that the vaccines were developed against, we call them clades, it's like cousins. They no longer exist. They've mutated on, and now we're looking at the Delta clade that's become predominant worldwide.
Well, that I ask, it's really interesting, some of the headlines that we are now seeing. Over the last few days, I've seen headlines, for instance, looking at Gibraltar, and the headline was, the most vaccinated part of the earth is now the part with the most COVID cases. And in Ireland and Israel and many others. And there seems to be this now confusion. The media are actually putting this information out in a bold headline like that. But it seems as though that the vaccine, which was supposed to combat COVID, is actually no longer working at all. So is that simply because it's mutated a new variant, or what is exactly is happening?
Yes, it's mutated into a variant that's capable of escaping the effects of the vaccine. This is a survival advantage for the virus. It's nothing unique to COVID-19. This is why when a new plan was formulated in 2005, the premise was to find a pre-existing drug that was safe and accurate and effective, and to use this, stock up on it, to use this in general practice in outpatients. So it's like the flu. You come in, you're not feeling well, you see your doctor. In this case, they would prescribe you one of these drugs. Take them by mouth, very cheap, about $11 for 11 tablets. A drug that had been around for 50 years. Used billions of doses over that time period. It was an anti-malarial drug. The Chinese were making tons of it and using it to bring their situation under control. India began to use it in the slums of Mumbai. And again, they were able to bring this fairly quickly under control. And the United States was able to acquire 62 million doses. And we started to use it here, chiefly in the New York area. All we needed was a simple piece of paper that said investigational new drug authority from the FDA. We didn't get that. Wow. Intentionally, we were given an emergency use authorization, an EUA, with a statement that this drug should only be given to patients that are in the hospital because it was very, very dangerous and it caused side effects in the heart, which could lead to death. So the studies that started to come out were all in late patients. Now, COVID-19 is a two-part infection. The first part of the infection is fairly mild. It's like a really severe head cold. And you feel miserable for a couple of days. And the majority of people go ahead and get over it. But if you have pre-existing comorbidities such as obesity, or you're over the age of 60, or you smoke a lot, cigarettes, or you have diabetes, or kidney disease, or high blood pressure. In a small percentage of these infections, the disease can take a much more lethal course. The first thing that starts is a shortness of breath. Typically, with the early strains of COVID, this was around day 7, day 8, after your first onset of symptoms with a fever and coughing, and you just feel miserable, you're tired. This is your immune system kicking in, giving a lot of these effects. If we can get the drug into you, and the earlier from the time of symptom onset, the better. It's like a fire on the stove. When a blaze starts on the stove, you don't wait until the curtains are on fire and the house is on fire to phone the fire department. You throw water on it. And in this case, this drug, hydroxychloroquine, I was speaking about, was the fire. And this had been discovered back in 2005. In fact, one of the leading spokespeople here, Dr. Anthony Fauci, this was for use should we have another SARS-1 type outbreak. And he was all for it. Now suddenly we get this emergency use authorization for hospital use. Well, that's silly. With any infection, you want to treat it early before you have to cut the leg off, right? That's just common sense. Anyway, doctors were still prescribing it off-label, and it was working very, very, very well. South Korea had used this along with intense, what we call contact tracing. You identify a patient, and you don't have to have testing. You can do this on clinical suspicion if the drug you have is very safe, and we had that. Anyway, to make a long story short, when you're in the more severe second stage of the disease and you're short of breath, the heart itself can be affected by the virus, and you can start developing abnormal cardiac rhythms, abnormal heartbeats. And people that have never had hydroxychloroquine or any drug for outpatient treatment, and we're in hospital, we're developing the same thing. The FDA intentionally banned the use of the drug in April. And like hypnosis, countries that had started to use it were bringing their pandemic under some degree of control, stopped. India had brought their slums under control within a couple weeks. They were down to almost zero cases. Brazil is an unusual place because you have some states in Brazil that are favorable to the current government and some states that weren't. The states that weren't favorable to the president and his party currently wouldn't use it. And the places that were favorable and did use it started bringing their hospitalizations right down to a level that they could manage. And then this excuse was given that, well, the drug wouldn't reach proper concentration to be effective based on FDA modeling, computer models, which are totally inaccurate. And the politics got involved. Governors of the states would come after you if you tried to prescribe it as a private physician. And it turned into a huge mess. And now we're on our fourth wave. Well, the problem is you cannot have an experimental vaccine rushed through testing if there's a safe and existing outpatient drug that you can use that's effective. So they had to get rid of hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
Physicians still use it with good results. There's another drug, ivermectin. But there was this whole sort of a global conspiracy to get rid of these very safe and effective drugs. Now, keep in mind, hydroxychloroquine isn't just an anti-malarial, but it's used for a lot of connective tissue disorders, like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or a disease called scleroderma. And none of these prohibitions on using it were for any of these other conditions.
How long has hydroxychloroquine been around? Because I know ivermectin has been around for quite a while.
About 50 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's precursor chloroquine. But you must keep in mind, they're two different drugs.
Yes, yeah. But they're safe, is what I mean. They've been tested for many, many years. And they're safe.
For years. There's very few drugs that we let pregnant women take or nursing mothers because it can appear in the breast milk. And there's no contraindication for breastfeeding mothers and pregnant women not to take this drug. So it was really perfect. Low cost, inexpensive. Production could be ramped up. We were using it. And then inexplicably, it was stopped. The United States, suddenly this COVID-19 panel appeared. Some of these people were well-educated and well-trained, but they were from the AIDS era, the HIV, which is a very long chronic disease, which takes many years to kill you. It wasn't something that does away with you in 20 days or puts you in such bad shape within the first 8 days that, you know, you end up on a ventilator. And we didn't understand a lot of things about the virus, like its ability to cause abnormal blood clotting. So our ICUs got a lot better at managing this. But it wasn't until around the 1st of July that the first large-scale papers started to appear in the United States for early treatment. Up until that time, the U.S. testing system for COVID was broken completely. And you were waiting 4 or 5 days to get results before you could start the hydroxychloroquine on the patient. Of course, they're not going to do good. No drug is going to work in a late patient. The idea is to stop it early. With the Delta strain, we need to stop it within the first 4 days, really, from symptom onset. So there was no contraindication to treating on suspicion. Doctors have been doing this for years. When you come in and see me for a cold, I don't send a swab off to see which one of 120 viruses you might have causing your cold symptoms. Oh, there's cold. It's cold season. Cold's going around. Seen a lot of cold cases. Most probably this is a cold case. Here's a very safe drug. Go home and take this. Sequester yourself. Don't go out. Don't kiss your family. You'll start to feel better in a couple of days. And by and large, that's what happened. Until they stopped using it. Then the doctrine became, come in and get tested. You're short of breath, but still go home. Or go home until you get short of breath.
Yeah.
And when you come into hospital, we'll give you hydroxychloroquine, but it won't work because now you're too sick. And very poor papers started to appear in the literature. Things that never should have been made it through peer review. A couple of these from a scientist called Boulware, when you actually go back and look at the papers, it did show a beneficial effect, but his sample size was too small. But the papers kept coming in, showing overwhelming benefit. Now, were they randomized clinical trials? No. Randomization means that you match your patients, who's going to get the drug and who isn't. This lot will get hydroxychloroquine, this lot won't get anything. By June, July, the evidence was so overwhelming that you could drop your mortality by 51% in the Ford study, 47% in the Mount Sinai study, and 67% drop in mortality in a large Spanish study. With these types of overwhelming efficacy and safety, cardiac events, we're talking several thousand patients here. Cardiac events weren't a feature of any of these trials. So observational studies are just as good as these randomized clinical trials for an infectious disease. In fact, it's almost malpractice. This drug was showing such benefit. It was actually malpractice if you didn't put your older patients on this. So that's the state of affairs. Everything shifted from early treatment to the vaccine will save us. And well, that's just ridiculous. That's basic virology says that this isn't going to be the case.
Well, on to that, the vaccine saving us, we, I think only 3 weeks ago or so, the FDA had approved or given emergency use authorization to the vaccines for younger children. Was it 11? For 5 to 11 year olds, it's already been used for that. My question is, and again, you in the paper you look at this, that children, one, are not passing it on, and two, are not affected in the same way, and three, we have a vaccine that isn't keeping COVID down in many countries, so why then roll it out to children? I mean, right. There's a whole lot of confusion on that area.
Well, it's being driven by the pharmaceutical companies now, which there's been enough pushback. We want to see the data from the first clinical trials. Pfizer was fined over $3 billion over the last decade for all sorts of nonsense. Fudging clinical trials was one of them. We want to see, and should have been given, the phase 1 and 2 data for clinical trials that they performed. They've now determined that, yeah, we can have this 55 years from now.
Yeah, how can they do? I saw that. How is that possible? How is that accepted? That it just seems madness that that would happen.
It is madness. It is madness. Doctors are still using it here, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. It's a drug that was used to eradicate river blindness to a large extent in Saharan Africa and other places. It's not a horse dewormer. In fact, the drug was given a Nobel Prize and the people involved with developing it. It's very safe.
So, I mean, what is the situation has been ruled out in children. We've got mandatory vaccines now being talked about in Europe. It hasn't got to that stage in the US, but I guess it will. But again, that whole area, you talk about the extremely low danger, the infection fatality rate being extremely low for children. Do you want to explain to the viewers what that is?
Yeah, well, the number of cases that you have that die. And it's like 0.02 in the 5 to 11 age group, with about maybe a 0.5 for every 5 years of age that you advance. When you're talking 0.02, there's 28 million children in the United States. Usually, when we've gone back and looked at this, it's children that have had, you know, serious pre-existing medical conditions that have died. Most children, the vast majority of children, will have mild symptoms, or they may not even know they have it at all. They don't generate a lot of virus in their upper airway, their nose, and their mouth. They don't really readily pass it on to other children. They don't readily pass it on to adults. There's a number of papers showing this. But what they do pick up is a long-standing, cross-reactive, superior immunity. So when you do see these little variants out there floating around, they're exposed to it, they're partially immune, and they just expand the repertoire of things that they should include in their immune response, including these variant viruses. But to do that, you have to have the children mixing and seeing each other. You can't lock a child down for a year and let him out, let him go back to school, and expect them to be immune to like the Delta clade, which is circulating now, because they haven't gone through those intermediary steps. It's madness. This is not, no one has ever fought a pandemic this way. It was an invention of Chairman Xi in China. And it was picked up by the WHO, promoted, and picked up by some clueless individuals here. And then the pharmaceutical companies got involved. So in the United States, go ahead.
No, I was wanting to ask another part which fits in a concern with children is looking at side effects. And again, that's something you cannot discuss and is not discussed in any of the mainstream media. And that, if you balance the risk of a child getting COVID and dying, and then you look at the possible side effects, do you want to explain just kind of how that works, the reporting in America and some of those figures coming out? The graph that I really caught my attention, which I've seen before, I'll bring up on the screen, is that graph looking at reporting of adverse reactions. And it seems as though this year something has happened, and you can only really put that down to the huge rollout of a vaccine for COVID. So, yeah, can you just give us a little bit of understanding about that, the side effects and VAERS and what that is and your concerns of that? Oh, he'll come back. I don't know why we froze there. Give him a moment, and Dr. Hatfield should be with us again. The links to everything will be in the description to the papers. They're out on social media. their own Telegram page. If you follow Getter, it's on that, on Gab. So it's out there, and I encourage you to go and have a look at it and read it. The website, until Dr. Hatfield joined, is drstephenhatfield.com. And this was originally in the London Centre for Policy Research. It was there that we first came across this, and it's on Dr. Hatfield's full website. Dr. Hatfield, we lost you for a minute.
Hi, I'm back.
Hello. I'm back. So explain to us this adverse reaction, VAERS, side effects, which is something that you're not allowed to discuss at all.
Yeah, it's outrageous. The FDA several years ago had put out a very large contract to improve their vaccine adverse event reporting system. And there were contractors that did this, and then suddenly they weren't interested. So you're bringing out an experimental vaccine, quote, biological product. It's never, ever been used large scale in humans before.
Yeah.
And you're looking at a 30-year-old shoddy system, inaccurate in the extreme, and behind the time to look for new side effects for these quote vaccines. It's insanity. It's malpractice. 2009, I think, they put out an H1N1 vaccine. And Guillain-Barré is a very serious paralyzing condition. Yeah. That's a side effect of some of the flu vaccines. And they had only reported 36% of the cases until well after the pandemic was over.
Wow.
So you don't have a real-time monitoring capability. And that means it's very insensitive, because there's a natural background rate of Guillain-Barré. There's a natural background rate of myocarditis. So you really have to have a lot of cases before you're getting an indication now that this is being caused by the vaccine, to the point where if it's going to take the FDA 55 years to determine, you know, to release the documents, then how could they make a decision in 108 days of clinical? 55 years compared to 108 days to make their decision. So this is all nonsense. We're assuming it's, I don't want to be speculative here, but people have made billions of dollars off of this. Okay. It's chiefly the Pfizer product that seems to be heavily associated with myocarditis, about 75% of the cases, probably 70-75%. The other big chunk is the Moderna vaccine. There's too much financial conflicts of interest. When they made the decision, the FDA made the decision that this will be extended down to 5-year-olds, 5 to 11-year-olds.
Yeah.
They had an outside panel meet. The FDA had an outside panel, and the CDC had an outside panel. One of the guys, and they voted overwhelmingly to give it to 5-year-olds. And one of the guys was interviewed afterwards. And apparently his reply was, well, how do we know the harmful effects if we don't give it to these kids? Well, this is insanity. For children that are naturally resistant to it with an almost infinitesimal death rate, you're going to give them a highly experimental vaccine that's causing rare but serious side effects. And by the way, there's no such thing as a mild case of myocarditis or inflammation of the heart. That heals by scarring. And that's going to cause some type of long-term effect as the patient gets older and into their senior years. You don't want to start out with a dicky ticker, you know?
And there's no way of knowing who will get cited. You mentioned that in the paper that you don't know.
All we know is that the second shot is what really seems to kick it off.
Hmm.
And there's no reason to vaccinate this age group.
Yeah.
Not at all. At the most, you might consider it for a child with really severe comorbidities. But there's no guarantee. And now here's the other thing, the data that's now appearing. I use British data, by the way, and Israeli data.
Yeah.
Britain is actually pretty honest about things. The United States isn't. There's too many conflicts of interest.
Hmm.
In fact, the current head of the FDA here, Janet Woodcock, was when she was lower down on the totem pole and in charge of drug safety. She was the one that instigated the ban on hydroxychloroquine.
Wow.
And had to recuse herself from any vaccine decisions later on because of her financial conflicts of interest.
Hmm.
So then we have Dr. Fauci. He's not been right on one thing since this began.
Hmm.
He does clinical drug trials.
Yeah.
And he uses his own people for these. When this started, the U.S. was totally unprepared, as I mentioned. Obama had gotten rid of everything. There was one guy left on the National Security Council, and one of the Republicans fired him. So we started something like the Manhattan Project, like to develop the atomic bomb in World War II.
Yeah.
We were trying everything, and vaccines were part of it. New drugs were part of it. We had to start, 80% of our drugs are made in China. We had to start getting critical drugs made on U.S. soil.
Hmm.
We didn't have enough personal protective equipment.
Yeah.
It's all made in China. So there were massive problems to address in a very quick period of time. I'll refer you to the president's advisor for trade and manufacturing policy, Peter Navarro, has just published a book called Trump Time, Journal of the Plague Years.
Hmm.
You can get it off Amazon. I haven't read it yet, but Peter's very outspoken.
Hmm.
And I think you can take that home, but this is what happened in the office.
Wow.
It was a mess. So now we have another problem, and we're seeing this in natural immune patients that are now forced to get the vaccine.
Yes.
And of course, they catch COVID.
Hmm.
And now it's worse. It's worse than if they remained unvaccinated.
Well, why is natural immunity not even looked at or accepted, that everyone must get vaccinated whether or not you are susceptible to having COVID because you're already immune because you've had it? So why is that not even taken into account?
Peter, then you couldn't sell millions of doses of vaccine and lose your mind over it. Yeah. There's a worldwide psychosis almost here.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a dogma now that vaccine is the way out of here. Well, the vaccines aren't working reliably, period. Okay? They're not preventing you from going into hospital in a reliable fashion. They're not preventing you from getting more severe disease in a reliable fashion.
Yeah.
And the next clade that comes out will probably be even more vaccine resistant. So in response, the CDC stopped counting the number of what we call breakthrough infections, people that were fully vaccinated that still catch COVID. So they're not counting that anymore unless you end up in hospital or die.
Hmm.
And then the count is weeks behind and not totally accurate. It takes about a half hour to fill in a VAERS form. You've been seeing patients all day. The doctors are exhausted. And you want to sit and spend 6 hours submitting bear reports on a computer. It's not a user-friendly thing. It takes about 20 minutes to fill one of these in. Nobody's got time for that.
But this means we're getting very high figures of adverse reactions, but they could just be a small part. So the figures could be much, much worse than what we're being told.
Yes. And there's been some papers out on this. We don't know, so I'm not going to speculate that how far behind we are in the actual figures. The truth is, nobody knows, because they're using a non-functional system.
Yeah.
It's a disgrace.
Dr. Hatfield, I think we'll bring it. There's so much more, but I think we will bring it to close. And I know that our viewers will want to get more. We put the link to the paper out on social media. I'll encourage our viewers to go to drstephenhatfield.com and you'll see the paper there at the top. Click on it and you'll get it. It's worthwhile reading into it. If you're a parent, if you've got nephews, nieces, whatever, you need to read this and understand it.
We mentioned Peter Navarro's book.
Yes.
My book is still available. It deals mainly with influenza, but how the plan should have rolled out would have been the same for influenza or the coronavirus. And 3 Seconds for Midnight, I think, is still up there. We tried to write it at the layman's level, and we go into why is this thing mutating all the time? So you get a little bit of background before we start talking about the plants. And the problem remains, you know, we're seeing at least one new, brand new infectious disease every year now. And there's worse things in Mother Nature still out there than the virus. It's time globally that we really got our act together here. And we're far from it.
Let me just share the screen of your book there. That's 3 Seconds Until Midnight. It is available on Amazon to our UK viewers. You can get it on paperback. You can get it on Kindle. And certainly after reading through two of your papers, Dr. Hatfield, in the last couple of weeks, I think it's a very worthwhile book. And it is fascinating that you were warning the US about the lack of readiness for this just months before it broke out. So I'd encourage our viewers to go get a hold of that, 3 Seconds Until Midnight, on paperback or Kindle. Dr. Hatfield, thank you for your time. It's a fascinating subject, and it's wonderful to have someone coming on who really understands and to explain to the rest of us who are just trying to grasp and understand what on earth is happening, especially in a time where you're not allowed to discuss this open and freely. So thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Let me just finish off with our viewers before I let you go, Dr. Hatfield. To our viewers or listeners, thank you for watching or listening. And on Thursday, we've got Carl Benjamin with us looking at the online safety bill, which is coming in, which seeks to restrict. It's looking at having a 14-year prison sentence for saying hurty words online, literally. If you say something that someone takes offense to, it could be up to 14 years in jail, the most restrictive bill across the whole of Europe on stuff, on words that are said online. So, on Thursday, Carl Benjamin will be with us for that. On a Wednesday, there's another info video coming out looking at what's happening across Europe on the forced vaccinations, on the lockdowns, on the riots that have been happening. So that's on Wednesday, a short video on that. So to our viewers and to our listeners, thank you for being with us. And drstephenhatfield.com is the website. I encourage you to go there. So thank you and good night to you all.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.